Good evening. So this is the last class in this series on this Rodney Smith Book of Awakening. And last time we got to getting near the end of Chapter 3 on the Divided Mind. We're up to page 55 in the book, and here's some highlights from last time to refresh our memory from where we were at. From page 52, this is exploring how identification with thoughts and feelings as a separate self is what tends to cause this feeling of separation and losing touch with this so-called formless awareness. On page 52, Rodney says, "In fact, we see that awareness is not an experience at all, but the ground from which all experiences arise." I thought that was a nice point. Does that make sense? You could even say, it's the one realm that's not an experience. It's the ground of all experiences. And if we think that we have an experience of awareness, then that's making it into some kind of object of awareness. Awareness itself can never be an experience. An experience is something that comes and goes as an object of awareness. So we can't actually like have it as an experience, and yet we can be it. In fact, we already are it. It's just a matter of knowingly being it, or taking our place as this awareness that we are. And another point, a highlight I thought from last time on page 54, he says, "Through careful observation or mindfulness, we see that all thoughts, emotions, and sensations that arise are not self. They are not our true self. We know that they are not self, because they can be seen as dependently arising from conditions." So, self here, usually in Buddhism, self means, and I think, well, there's various definitions of self in the dictionary, but the one in religious language, usually by self, we mean some essential core of who we really are. We might say, our personality is kind of like a self, too. That our thoughts and feelings are kind of like a dependently arising, conditioned kind of self, in quotation marks. But they're not really like... We feel as if there's something more than that that is our self. Something essential, unchanging, permanent, singular. And that's what's the Buddha is always directing us to see, that we can't find such a thing. So again, through careful observation, we see that all thoughts, emotions, and sensations in the body and mind that arise are not our true self, because they're just dependently arisen from conditions. So therefore, we can't grasp them as like our true identity. They're just a flow of experience that we let come and go. And no problem with that. The problem is when we kind of lump them together into this sense of a core personal identity. And then that one is the one that's like, that view of the independent self is the one that seems to suffer and have the problems and feels threatened, worried, afraid, attached, averse, confused, proud, ashamed, and so on. Yeah. All those experiences I just named are just arising and ceasing experiences. They're not ourself, but when we lump them together, we feel like there's some package that is ourself, and we grasp that. Yeah? So, let's continue on page 55. Oh, well, you could just listen along. Yeah? Yeah.
And
I don't.
Fifty-two?
55? Oh, do you have this page now?
Okay,
so...
55?
Sure, yeah.
As resistance decreases, the nature of objects and the subject become known. It was resistance, the fear, avoidance, or wanting something from it, that kept an object from the formless, and it is to the formless that all objects return when not invested with our preferences. It is a little like trying to see the screen of a movie as the movie runs. In this analogy, the movie is the forms and stories of our lives, and the screen is the formless awareness that is the ground of all experiences. Our investment is in the movie, to understand and empathize with the story and drama. But when we focus on the movie alone, we miss the backdrop of the screen. The screen is unimportant because it says nothing about the story unfolding from the movie. The screen is present the entire time, but it's the forms on the screen that hold our interest.
Yeah, so some of you maybe have heard this metaphor before. Personally, I think it's one of my favorite metaphors because I think that in the old days, before there were movies, the same metaphor was often presented as a mirror and the images on the mirror. But similarly, it demonstrates the inseparability between the images and the screen, and how it's... And the fact that we're never really paying attention to the screen, which is the ground from which all experiences or movies arise, because there's nothing really there to look at. It's not an experience. It's the ground of experiences. And yet we can, in a sense, be the screen that we are. We can settle into being the screen while still watching the movie. Yeah? We've talked about this metaphor in the past. Does that make sense? Anyway. Just to celebrate it a little bit further, Suzuki Roshi uses the same metaphor in Not Always So. He's got a chapter called Everyday Life is Like a Movie. This is how Suzuki Roshi puts it. Our everyday life is like a movie playing on the wide screen. It's not like a small TV or something here. It's a wide screen. It's wider than wide, right? It's a boundless screen. Most people are interested in the picture on the screen without realizing there's a screen. When the movie stops and you don't see anything anymore, you think, I must come again tomorrow evening. I'll come back and see another show. When you're just interested in the movie on the screen and it ends, then you expect another show tomorrow, or maybe you're discouraged because there's nothing good on right now. You don't realize the screen is always there. But when you're practicing, you realize your mind is like a screen. If the screen is colorful, colorful enough to attract people, then it will not serve its purpose. So to have a screen which is not colorful, to have a pure, plain, white screen, is the most important point. But most people are not interested in the pure, white screen. Isn't it so? He goes on to say, that white screen is not something... Oh, Zazen practice is necessary to know the kind of screen you have and to enjoy your life as you enjoy movies in the theater. I think this is never saying, don't enjoy the movie, but also enjoy the screen at the same time. But in fact, they're inseparable. That white screen is not something that you can actually attain. It's something you already have. Or I might even tweak that slightly and say, it's something that you already are. You can't actually have the screen. And you can't attain the screen. You can't experience the screen. But you can be the experiencing screen. Knowingly. Like it's, you know, not just have faith that we are the screen, but you can actually have the sense that you are the screen. So it's almost like it's an experience. The reason you don't feel you have it, Suzuki Roshi says, is because your mind is too busy. Once in a while, you should stop all your activities and make your screen white. That is Zazen. So, of course, it's easier to remember the screen and be the screen when we're quiet and still and nothing else is happening. I shouldn't say nothing else is happening. The movie's still happening, but the movie is very, it's a very calm movie. It's just like looking at a still landscape with maybe just a couple birds going by or something, and we can remember the backdrop. But when we're very involved in the particularities of the movie and it's a dramatic movie, then it's very hard to remember the screen. But hopefully through Zazen, we're training to remember the screen in more and more busy situations. But admittedly, this is difficult. This is, I think, one way to look at Zazen. Formal Zazen, like in the Zendo, is it's getting more and more used to being the screen, and actually investigating the relationship between the movie and the screen in Zazen more and more thoroughly, deeply, carefully, and ongoingly, so that then when we get up off the cushion, we can maybe remember a little bit more easily. Yeah. Often that's how I would look at Zazen practice. So, please, continue.
So too.
When the objects of the world become less persuasive, and when the subject becomes more porous and insubstantial, the formless background begins to hold our interest. As we begin to notice the back thought that holds the form, the divided mind opens to the sacred, unified mind. The patterns and images on the movie screen are never separated from the screen. In fact, they are the same composition. Much like the movie, the foreground form and the background formlessness are understood as a single essence. As the Buddha said, merging with the deathless are all things. Terminating in nirvana are all things.
So this is, I think, really profound, and it's another point here being made now, worth stopping a moment to look at this, that it's not just like we're kind of letting the movie recede to the background and letting the screen come to the foreground, because the screen of formless awareness is always free and never harmed by the movie that's playing on it. You could say that's one of the main reasons we are talking about the screen here, is that the screen is like a nirvana screen, right? It's the nirvanic screen. Knowingly being the screen, could even go so far as to say, is nirvana, meaning like freedom from suffering. If we can, sustain that in an ongoing way and trust it in all situations, this is more like nirvana. So, but in this case, we're seeing that the screen and the movie are never separate. In fact, they're the same composition, which we could say, like, what is the movie actually made of? It's made of the screen. So what are experiences? Our experiences of pleasure and pain and thinking and emotion and sensation, what are these experiences made of? They're made of the formless awareness. Right? That's their, in other words, that's their nature. That's what they really are. And they're like, they're manifesting on the screen. But actually what they are is the screen. Yeah? I think this is why this metaphor is so beautiful. And this is where we're actually getting into non-duality. If we just say, be the screen and let the movie just do its thing, that's not necessarily non-duality. That is very liberating. But non-duality is when the movie is seen to be the screen. Yeah? Like, not something that's playing on the screen that could be removed from the screen, but actually the nature of the movie is screenness. The nature of thoughts and feelings and sensations is the knowing of them, is the awareness of them. Yeah. So, as he says here, the foreground form and the background formlessness are understood as a single essence. This is like non-duality. As the Buddha said, merging with the deathless are all things. So the deathless is one of the Buddha's epithets or names for formless awareness, because it's not born and it doesn't die. Merging with the deathless are all things, all phenomena, all experiences, all the relative coming and going things are actually the deathless. Terminating in nirvana are all things. That's an amazing statement from the Pali Suttas of non-duality, radical non-duality. Terminating in nirvana are all things, not just like our true nature is nirvana, but all phenomena are in their nature nirvana. And similarly to this, Dogen, almost identical actually, Dogen Zenji, many centuries after the Buddha, says in a few places, he actually, I don't know if it's quoting something earlier, because Dogen says it in a couple of different essays, but he says, referring to one mind, and one mind in Chinese Buddhism and Zen is one of the ways of talking about Buddha nature or formless awareness. It's actually kind of like a technical term. When you see one mind, it doesn't just mean our usual mind, thinking mind, one mind, from some early Chinese treatises. It was a kind of poetic, descriptive way of talking about the formless awareness, because it's not multiple. It's indivisible. It's one. So Dogen's saying is, one mind is all things. All things are one mind. Almost identical to the Buddha saying, merging with the deathless are all things. Terminating in nirvana are all things. These are all expressions of the non-duality between phenomena that come and go, experiences that come and go, and the deathless background of the one mind. Can you understand this point? At least conceptually? Because this is, I think, an amazing point. I'd say, if you really understand this, like, deeply, it's like the end of your life, as you know it.
This is it.
All things, from now on, are terminating in nirvana, in the deathless. So I think it's good to get this conceptually, and more to reflect on it conceptually, and then to actually realize that it's not just a nice way of talking. This is so, and granted, it's a subtle understanding, and it's a paradigm shift of the heart, and we can remember it over and over, and we can open to it more and more deeply, and truly, and non-conceptually. Yes.
So, what would be an experience of that the terminating is the one I'm
talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. All things terminate in nirvana.
Yeah.
Like, I can understand or feel the, you know, the movie and the screen, DVD, that's kind of like being actualized by the myriad things. There's something about being, you know, that which is happening, that the flow that is happening is it. It's not a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the nirvana, the all things terminate in nirvana.
Yeah, it's a little bit like he said, Rodney, the author, said earlier, what did he say? It is to the formless that all objects return when not invested with our preferences. That one stood out to me too, which I think similar. And it's a way of talking about, it's saying, I understand it as maybe a way, another metaphor that would work for this is like the waves in the ocean of Buddha nature, sometimes called the ocean, Buddha nature ocean, but the formless awareness, ocean meaning like it's boundless and you can't see its depths, but on the surface it manifests waves. And the waves are made of water, just like the movie is made of the screen. And but in this metaphor, the waves are kind of like arise out of the water, arise out of this ocean, in this particular form and shape, and then they settle back down into it a moment later. So in that way, you could say experiences are like arising from the awareness and then dissolving back into the awareness. Is one way we could talk about or kind of imagine conceptually what all these things are, what all this experience is. It's not coming from somewhere outside of awareness. The awareness is not inside of us either. This awareness is boundless. We all share this awareness, and then the awareness manifests itself as all these waves, like you and me and pain and pleasure and the room and the street and the town, and then all those things when we as soon as the experience ends, the experience of like a sound, you could say, then that sound almost like dissolves back into the awareness from which it arose,
and that's the object terminating in your mind.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly if that's what Buddha meant, but you could see it that way. Mm-hmm. All things terminate in nirvana. Terminate means like end, right? Doesn't it?
Like that.
Well, what terminates is my objectification of it. It's like the experience is continuing, right? But where we get caught up is that we fix on it and we make it into an object and we try to hold it still and we make story and we get identified with the movie.
Well, I would understand that experience is just a momentary thing. No experience actually continues. It's like a wave. It arises for just a moment, and then it ceases. And then another one very similar to it. Sometimes if we feel like there's an ongoing pain or something, it's not really even in the early teachings, the Buddha would say, it's not really that it's one long experience of pain. It's a moment-to-moment waves. They only last one moment. And then you could say that when that wave settles back into the ocean, the pattern of that wave creates another wave that arises the next moment. So for us, it looks almost identical to the previous moment of pain, until at some point it's not, because nothing's permanent, but by impermanence, the Buddha was really referring to this radical impermanence that nothing lasts more than a moment, actually. And then it terminates in nirvana, and a new experience arises.
Okay.
And you could say, and then your point about not grasping an experience, maybe we could say grasping the wave, grasping the experience, then it seems to not terminate in nirvana, right? Then it seems to like grip us and it may be also by grasping an experience of, say, pleasure or aversion to pain, it seems to actually continue it, and it seems to become more and more permanent and extended, longer experience, but without grasping it, it immediately terminates in nirvana and a new one arises, which could be very similar to the previous, and it still might be pain, what we call painful, but now it has a sense of like it's just a bunch of waves arising on the water.
And that is then the way that you can work yourself through really, really difficult situations and painful situations.
Yeah.
Is this moment and then this moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, just...
Mm-hmm. So one way would be just to see there, to really get into the impermanence of the moment-by-moment difficulty, and like, okay, we made it through that moment. Here's another one. And then you could see, and even deeper and hard, and I would say harder to do practice when we're really having a hard time, is this seeing how it not only ceases, but it terminates in nirvana. It's a little bit different than just seeing how an experience is impermanent and is changing moment to moment. That's one insight, and another insight would be that when it ceases, it terminates in the formless awareness from which it arose. And both of those are actually really helpful. But the terminating in nirvana is, if it's a really difficult situation, it might be very hard to see that part, because that's when the background of it, when the movie gets really dramatic. It is truly difficult to basically to remember the screen. It's always equally, you know, available. But I think for me anyway, that I just forget the screen when the movie is a really intense movie. That's why we like intense movies, right?
Yeah, those are the good ones.
Yeah, we can get really involved in them. Yes.
Maybe a link between like the impermanence and the ending in nirvana is just that sense of the, it's the essential emptiness.
Yeah.
I think. So it's mm-hmm. like things are impermanent, but you are experiencing them, but you still have a sense of their essential emptiness, even as maybe you're, you know, spun into them.
Yeah. Which is also, we could, you know, tease out the difference between impermanence and emptiness, which often get kind of conflated together. Things are empty just because they're changing, but in fact they're two different teachings, and emptiness is a more subtle teaching. Things are arising and ceasing, and or they appear, conditioned things appear to arise and cease. In a way, impermanence is a teaching, a conventional teaching about dependently co-arisen appearances, and emptiness is that they don't arise and cease. As last week we talked about how in the Heart Sutra says that in emptiness, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease. So it's almost like saying they're not impermanent. In emptiness, things are not impermanent because they're not actually things that can arise and cease. Not just because they're changing very fast, it's that they're actually mental projections, we could say. And even impermanence is a kind of mental projection. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
So, could you talk about post-traumatic stress and the way time is held there? It's the separation is what is continuing.
Well, maybe. Yeah. Or any memory of something painful is the same principle. And memories get held in the body as well as the mind. And later in this, well, chapter 4, if we get to it, there's a talk about forgiveness too, which is the principle he gets into, as I recall, is separating the story from the physical sensation. Or at least that's how I would look at both with, I can't forgive myself for something I did, and I keep running through the story and the pain that's associated, or I can't forgive somebody else, and my story is so wrapped around the painful experience I had with them. And post-traumatic stress would be the same, I think. It would be very extreme pain connected with the memory of a storyline event that happened. So I think one way we could at least start to work with it, start to unravel the continuity of it, is to try to separate the physical sensation from the story, from the conceptual story. And so especially like in Zazen, I think, but even any outside of Zazen, to really stay more with the physical sensation. And it's not like the story is going to disappear, but just put some space between them. You can still have the story, but when the story is wrapped together with the pain, with the painful sensation, that's such a powerful, graspable, painful thing. So we can separate them a little bit. Okay, here's a story of this event. It's just a memory of a story. And then here's this painful sensation right now that's connected with the story from the past. Maybe partly focusing on the sensation is it's less confusing than the conceptual story. And the sensation we get to see, if we really start being mindful of just the physical sensation, we see that it's now, it's happening now. And then we can maybe see also that the story that we're remembering is also happening now. And that really starts to unravel this thing. Almost when you put them together, it's almost like reenacting the past.
Yeah.
It's like the physical sensation that happened in the past, or something similar to the painful event in the past, is happening now. So it's almost like we're reliving the story because the pain is happening now. Something like that.
Totally.
It might take a while, of course, to separate these with mindfulness and see that the whole thing is happening now. But when we see that it's always happening now, that's what really, I think, can start to release us from all these old things that are carrying on in our mind and body. Yeah. But, it's not a quick fix, of course. But in meditation, there's possibility, I think. And that's, I think, one of the great principles, is separating the physical sensation from the story. With all, even just, even putting aside post-traumatic stress from something that happened in the past. Something that's happening now where we're really disturbed is, I think, any disturbing emotion is always this combination of physical sensation and a conceptual story. And it's like we don't get rid of them, but if we separate those two just a little, we can really start to... Yeah, but same practice, right? We're feeling the pain now. Because actually, it's happening, it's really only happening right now. From the formless paradigm, there's nothing but now. It seems like a stream of time leading from the past to the present moment, but the formless awareness, as we said earlier, is like a timeless presence, the eternal now. There isn't any other time, actually, from that perspective. Nothing has ever happened to us in the past from the formless paradigm. A memory of it could be very vivid right now, but that's right now. So yeah, 56. Yeah.
I just have to say that the still arising of
How's that?
I'm just wondering, it came into my mind when you were describing this impermanent phenomena arising.
Yeah, well, I think...
They're not permanent.
Well, maybe another way to say that is a nice Buddhist model for these types of things are this model called the two truths, of the conventional truth and the ultimate truth, and that they're always inseparable. But when we're talking about these things, we can say the dependently arisen appearances of thoughts and emotions and sensations and experiences are what we call conventional truth. And in conventional truth, those things are impermanent. They arise and cease. And they come and go and so on. And from the ultimate truth of the formless awareness, nothing is coming and going. So the movie metaphor works nicely, right? The movie is impermanent, constantly changing, but the true nature of the movie is actually the screen. The movie is actually made of the screen, so the true nature of the movie is not impermanent. It's not coming and going, right? The water that the waves are made of is not impermanent, if we understand the metaphor like this. The water never changes, but the forms on the surface of it are impermanent and constantly changing.
Wow, that's helpful. Thank you.
And so that's a nice way to distinguish impermanence from emptiness. Right? Mm-hmm.
56. When experiences arise within a divided mind, judgment results. When experiences are perceived within a unified mind, there is just seeing without judgment. Get a sense of the two forms of perception throughout the day. Notice that the unified mind is without a commentator and free of the story, while the divided mind has a strong narrative full of opinion. Is it possible to move from a divided to a unified perception? What must happen for that to occur?
Yeah. Well, anyone have a response? What must happen for that to occur? Nothing? That's pretty good. Actually, that's true from the deepest level, that nothing has to happen, right? Earlier we had this this discussion about effort to try to practice better, attain something, or realize something. It's always, effort is always a kind of non-acceptance of the moment, actually. Even wholesome, good effort, in a way, from this deepest perspective, trying to do something is almost, I think, inevitably overlooking what is already the case. So it's not to say that conventionally there's no effort in practice, of course, but from this deepest perspective, it's kind of like effortless. Like on page 52, the Buddha says, every form of suffering grows out of effort. Whew. That's a radical quote, too, from the early teachings. So that's right. Nothing needs to happen. And yet, if we feel like we're caught in the form paradigm, how do we make the paradigm shift? Without any...
To be aware of when your mind is rushing on to something, when you sense that you're judging and reacting to something, that to me would be a sign that you're
divided. Yeah, that's great, yeah. When you're aware of the divided mind, that's... which doesn't necessarily take any effort. You might just... Through conditioning, you could say, it's one way to look at ongoing practice, is we're just conditioning ourselves to remember, to notice that it's a divided mind more quickly and easily. And we could also say, and if we remember this teaching that the divided mind is the movie that is made of the screen of formless awareness, the more we get familiar with that, then maybe it's enough to just notice, oh, divided mind. And as soon as we notice divided mind, we think, I know what divided mind is. It's the ocean of formless awareness. But if until we get really familiar with that, it might be a two-step process. One might be, oh, I'm really caught in divided mind right now. And that's already where, like, it's maybe like 80% right there. But then it might be like, okay, and just accept it. Just be with it. This is still part of this 80%. And you could say the other 20% might be like making this conscious remembrance or paradigm shift of like, is awareness present right now? The way I like to keep talking about it. Which is a little bit different than just being aware of the divided mind. They could happen simultaneously, but they don't necessarily.
I found it really helpful when I was first starting practice. Catherine pointed me to Dogen's take the backward step,
yes,
and turn the light of awareness around.
Yes.
I find that little phrases,
yes,
really help me remember,
mm-hmm,
and cut through the habitual thinking.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Take the backward step.
That's interesting that what I wrote, a note here, what must happen for that to occur? Take the backward step. So, it's a good one. Yeah.
And I think what precedes it in is something about, you know, stop and you know, hanging on to spinning the words.
Yeah.
What precedes,
yeah, that. Seesaw the movements of the conscious mind, the gauging of all thoughts
there
and views.
Yeah, I mean, it's right there.
Yeah. So this is Dogen's instructions for Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi. And he says, I like how he also says, instead of take the backward step, literally he says, learn the backward step. Because it's kind of like, it's something we just learn, and then once we learn how it works, then maybe we don't even take it. It takes us. Learn the backward step. It turns the light of awareness around and shines it back onto itself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away, and your original face will manifest. You could say, body and mind of themselves will drop away is a little bit like all things terminate in nirvana. Mm-hmm. For one moment, and then they arise again. So if, and I would say let's go on instead of stopping to do this as a silent practice, because there's more coming up. Chapter 4. I handed some out last week. Do y'all? I have three more here. You can share them. Chapter 4. It's page 57 in the book. So chapter 4 is Governing Laws of the Formless Paradigm. So he's kind of like, I think, nicely weaving back and forth. Like the last chapter was about the divided mind, and this one is about governing laws of the formless paradigm. In fact, I think he's mixing up the two paradigms in each chapter and talking about both, but it's nice to look at both, keep exploring the laws of the formless paradigm, and also keep studying how the divided mind and the suffering, deluded mind works, the sense of the separate, independent self, and the formless awareness. So, page 57.
Have a space of time between them. As the thinker, I ponder them into the reality, the mind is struggling to process. This gap makes it feel like control and making decisions and observing the necessary effort to correct whatever problems arise. All of this is an illusion, of course, since the eye and images from the senses are all arising as mental activity within the mind, and there is nothing independent of this mental activity, and no time gap between them. More thoughts occur after the image is seen, but the image and the sense of self arise simultaneously. As sobering as this may seem at first, is directly observable, and therefore the perception can be corrected and most significantly separation ended. Authentic spiritual practices are systems that directly address the subject-object separation and question the false assumptions of the divided mind. As we saw in the previous chapter, Buddhism is meant to do just that. These false assumptions include the sense of time, distance, and our egoic image and identity, which result in struggle, isolation, separation, fascination with objects, and the pursuit of pleasure. Authentic practices encourage the understanding of the entire range of self-centered activity, from reactivity to willful effort, and work to extract the sense of self from all that arises, including all states of mind. Each self-invested state of mind obscures the formless because the energy from the attached view recycles back into the formation of self. When energy is released through understanding the sense of self rather than supporting information, the energy moves into the formless.
Yeah, so a lot there. So, sometimes I think as he's writing, he makes it sound so simple and easy, right? As sobering as this may seem at first, we can just observe it, and then the perception can be corrected. It's like not so easy to correct our sense of the self as the five skandhas, body and mind and so on. These things are so deep. They're like innate. So... But it's on the other hand, it's true that the Dharma is just amazingly offering these unraveling teachings to help us see how it works, and it can be, I think, quite a gradual process actually of doing this too, and deepening our understanding slowly, trying it out slowly, working with strong habits, slowly change. Nothing happens as instantly as we'd like to imagine in a sudden school. We can have a sudden, maybe we have a sudden paradigm shift, but the way it plays out in our life, I think, is always going to be quite gradual, except for very rare circumstances. So some things here, when he said, work to extract the sense of self from all that arises, I thought that was a little bit strong. I would say more like work to clearly see the sense of self. It's not exact. If we talk about it as extracting it, it almost sounds like it's something that we have to remove. It's more like it's just a thought, as was said earlier. It's a conceptual thought or a misperception. So it's not really that we remove it. Sometimes that language is used, but I'd say more like clearly seeing. Another great metaphor about non-duality is in a bunch of different Indian traditions, they use this image of the snake and the rope, right? And so you see a snake in the dark, and you're afraid, and it brings up all these feelings of fear and aversion. And then you look closer, and you see that it's not actually a snake; it's just a piece of rope. And the nice thing about this metaphor is it goes along with this kind of like emotional responses to this misperception, right? Because you're actually afraid and averse. But as soon as you see that it's a rope, you're suddenly relieved, and you feel kind of silly, even like, oh, I was so scared. Maybe if some adrenaline's flowing, it keeps flowing for a little bit because you were just scared. But in fact, nothing's feeding the adrenaline anymore, and you're just relieved, and almost like it's almost like getting a joke or something, right? And so I think that's a great metaphor to point this out. And I think it shows nicely how nothing is removed, right? You don't have to get rid of the snake. You just see that the snake is not a snake. It's a shift. It's a paradigm shift of the heart and mind. Later, by the way, he has a chapter on the heart that also talks about emotions some. But he says what I mean by heart, Godley Smith, is formless awareness. So it can have a kind of a loving quality, but it's not something other than the formless awareness itself. I call it heart. Also, this investigation of the illusion of the separate self, of the I, that's connected with the body and mind, we could say is another one of the waves on the ocean. So we don't actually say the separate self, we shouldn't say the separate self is a wave that arises on the ocean, because there is no separate self. But we say that this sense of being a separate self, the feeling and thought and experience of seeming to be a separate self, that experience is a wave that's arising on the ocean, or that is part of the movie on the screen. Right? So we could even say the true nature of this constricted thought and feeling of being a separate, individual, limited body and mind, subject to birth and death, self, the nature of that thought, feeling, and experience is formless awareness, or Buddha nature. You could say that thought of the separate self terminates in nirvana, and it's made of formless awareness. It would be a kind of a non-dual way to look at it. Therefore, it's definitely cannot be extracted, because from this ocean, nothing can ever be extracted. Because this ocean is all-inclusive. There's nothing outside of this ocean. And nothing could be put outside of the ocean. If the slightest bit could be removed from this ocean, then it would not be the unconditioned, formless awareness. It would be, a tiny bit of it would be conditioned. Conditioned meaning impermanent and coming and going. A little piece that could be extracted would destroy, would make the ocean not the ocean. The slightest thing. Like, couldn't we just change something a little bit and then have a nice nirvanic ocean?
Nope, not
a thing. Couldn't we take a few scales off that snake? So it would be a little less, take the rattle off it or something, so it would be a little less scary. That's completely ridiculous, because it's not a snake.
You kind of allow that sense of self, or the way to just kind of release that.
Yeah, yeah, release back.
Into what it really is.
Yeah. Just, we can see it arise as a thought, and notice that that's what it is. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is we could do two approaches. One is just like the thought of constricted self arises, and just one approach would be just like, who is aware of this right now? And we remember the ocean, and then as soon as we remember, it dissolves back in. Another approach would be like to take the time to investigate the sense, because you could say there might be, that's how we could kind of work with habits. So I think maybe habits could have these two approaches. And maybe we could say the more ultimate approach to a habit or a sense of self or a painful feeling would be immediately just to remember its true nature. And kind of classical Zen, this is kind of the approach, is just kind of cutting through immediately. And it doesn't even matter what type of habit and so on. But early Buddhism and other traditions like psychotherapy and stuff might be like, before we do that, or even maybe as we're doing that, we can also like really check out how the conventional appearances work. Those habitual feelings of self and so on, we can kind of investigate and unravel them so they don't just keep continuing. And I think, see how those are two different approaches? And they could be combined. I think it's good to, work on both sides, actually. Just to put it, as we're talking about the sense of self here, just to throw in a little footnote that just because I the last week I've been really looking into these teachings about the Atman and Anatman and not-self in the Buddha's teaching. And partly I'm interested because the Buddha nature teachings in the Lankavatara Sutra, and particularly the Mahaparinirvana Sutra in the Mahayana, speaks of this formless awareness as true self, as an Atman again. So it really, and it's a controversial topic, and some people say, then it's not Buddhism anymore. And some say, yes it is, because the Buddha says, this Atman is ungraspable, formless, and empty. Anyway, there's a lot of modern teachers and practitioners and scholars have looked into this matter, and there's still debate about it. But some say that actually when Buddha was teaching Anatman, one of the classic Buddha's teachings from the early teachings, meaning often translated as no self, but we could also translate it as just not self, because the early teachings of the Buddha are just saying form is not myself, feelings are not myself, the five skandhas, these conditioned things, are not the Atman, as opposed to making an ontological statement of there is no Atman, there is no self. He's just saying all these conditioned things are not yourself. He doesn't exactly say in the earliest set of teachings there is no self. He just even when somebody asked him once in one classic sutta in the Pali Canon, somebody from another school where they had the view of an Atman said, Buddha, sir, is there a self or not a self? And the Buddha just remained silent. He didn't say there's not a self. And I think Ananda or somebody, one of his attendants, after the person left, said, why didn't you answer? And the Buddha said, if I had said there is a self, then this person would have just grasped his usual view of a self. What if I, because people usually tend to subtly at least grasp some view of a self. And if I said there isn't a self, he would have gotten really confused and it would have taken a longer Dharma talk to see, because he understands the self. And so it's more like the Buddha just had this very practical method. He's not like, we don't even need to get into kind of metaphysics of is there a self or not. And in the early teachings, it's not even so much, let's try to find the formless awareness. He was more just like, let's see what causes suffering. And what causes suffering is grasping the conditioned things that are not myself and thinking that the conditioned things like body and mind are myself. So let's see that those are not myself. So you could say that whole teaching could fit quite nicely with the teaching of the Upanishads about an Atman. It's not that they're necessarily contradictory. And there's all kinds of subtlety here. Some people say they are. But an interesting image that Chandrakirti uses, it was a later middle way commentator, and he's talking about the teaching of Anatman and unraveling the sense of the self that is the five aggregates, that we're somehow connected with the body and mind self, is really what he's working with. And Chandrakirti, as I understand it, says something like, we can refute the Atman of the Upanishads and these other pre-Buddhist schools that say that there's this form, that there is an unborn, boundless awareness called an Atman, that everything is comes from. He says we can refute that, but that doesn't touch the our self-grasping, that's grasping this body and mind as myself. So he's saying, I'll read you that actual quote, because I thought this was nice. Some think that when no self is understood, this means refutation of a permanent existent self, like something separate from the body and mind, like a kind of godlike self, or Atman, or a Brahman. But of our ego clinging, this could never be the ground. In other words, this Upanishadic Atman is not the ground of our ego clinging. The ground of our ego clinging is thinking that this body and mind is the Atman. And that's actually what the teachings say. We feel as if I am this body and mind, and that's why we suffer so much. So it's almost like a different kind of Atman. And Atman just means self in Sanskrit. So I think it can be used in these two different ways. So it's not necessarily that Buddha's refuting the Upanishads Atman. And then Chandrakirti goes on. So of ego clinging, this Upanishadic Atman, as I understand it, cannot be the ground of ego clinging. How strange to say that understanding that there's no religious kind of Atman suffices to uproot the belief in I. And he says, I love this metaphor. The Indians love metaphors. He says, this is like a person who finds a snake's nest in his wall and overcomes his fright by saying, it's not an elephant. A method such as this to cure the fear of snakes is a sure way to be a laughing stock. So it's a kind of funny metaphor. I don't know if you can get that, but basically saying, we're trying to relieve suffering, and my suffering comes from grasping the body and mind as my Atman self. And then we say, we just refuted the Upanishad's Atman through this reasoning, and like, there, we did it, now I'm free, right? And that's like saying, the snake, which is my grasping to the five skandhas as myself, I'm trying to relieve the pain of this self by saying, refuting this elephant, which doesn't really matter to refute this earlier kind of religious kind of Atman. Do you follow? Yeah, what does it have to do with our suffering? Yeah. I thought that was very cool to hear. And because I love these other traditions, like the Vedantic traditions that talk about formless awareness. And some people will say, we could probably find contradictions, but as the traditions developed, Buddhism and Vedanta in particular in India, they started cross-fertilizing each other a lot, but in both directions. So what came to be the more later versions of like Advaita Vedanta is highly influenced by like the mind-only teachings of Buddhism. They even use the same terminology and so on. And vice versa. I think the Buddha nature teachings are partly influenced by Vedanta. So in the end, they're a lot less different than they sometimes are made out to be. And I think the earlier versions, the Buddha does critique other views in the early suttas of other schools, but they were like many, many centuries before these non-dual traditions developed side by side very similarly. So anyway, that's a long footnote. Yes, are you? Didn't bring that page with me, but I've been looking into the Upanishads recently because of this, and they sound very similar to Buddha nature teachings, actually. Basically, the Atman is something that doesn't change, it doesn't come and go, it's the source of everything, it is our true self, and those are some qualities. And then the Brahman is like the reality of the universe, and even in early Upanishads, it's a part of way of looking at the goal of practice is to unite the Atman and the Brahman, which is a little bit like saying, we could kind of say that Brahman is the entire appearance of the universe, all the forms that we see, which are actually formless themselves, but they appear as the universe. And Atman is like the knowing quality. So you could say that uniting these is a little bit like all things terminate in nirvana. like all the entire universe of things we call Brahman terminates in the Atman of formless awareness. So Indian traditions have very similar ways of talking about this, and they're always based around consciousness and awareness as opposed to Western traditions, which are less that way. A lot more could be said about the Upanishads, and I'm not an expert. So, page 57.
Essentially, spiritual practice dismantles the entire paradigm of self, the complete virtual reality constructed from thought. This is where most of us fear to tread. It is one thing to play spiritual hide-and-seek with the egoic identity, looking and seeing how it forms and observing its composition and dependency on thought. This feels as if everything was being seen, but only from the safety of the seer and within the established world order. It is another thing to dismantle the misconstrued life on which the self is built. When we do that, we deconstruct our worldview, what we have taken life to be, and our entire life set of assumptions. Like a house of cards, the sense of self comes tumbling down, pulling with it the current paradigm of self. Though we may be hesitant to go in that direction, that is precisely where awareness must inevitably go.
He's strict. Yeah.
Spiritual hide-and-seek.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know, we could see this on in different ways, but I think it's a little bit like, I hear this as kind of, how far do we want to take this?
Yeah.
How far down the rabbit hole do we want to go? And, because maybe we do, in the setting of a class like this, we can see how we can deconstruct these illusory ideas, and in Zazen we can do this, and then but in our daily life I think there's so many cherished habits constructed world that we're invested in, right? So I think this is why it's endless, basically. I think the application of the Dharma to our actual life is endlessly possible to deepen, and we can just see moment to moment how we take for granted the form paradigm in our daily life. So this is, again, you could say the very gradual process, and how much we're willing to let awareness flow into all the nooks and crannies of our life. So, Ari, shall we continue?
Look around for a moment and become aware of the reality the mind has created. Everything you know or have known, all of your plans, expectations, and direction. Imagine you are an anthropologist entering this reality for the first time in order to study its composition. What you think about life, how it is configured, what you take it to be, what you want from it and where it is going, all of that, without exception, is thought created. Relaxing into the view without asserting or forcing a particular vantage point begins to reveal a non-directed life. Notice the sense of abiding that was absent when thoughts formed your life, and the sense of space and ease. Here life is lived within a playing field of wonder and innocence, and is not built upon time, distance, separation.
Everything you have, everything you know or have known, all plans, expectations, and directions are mind-created. Which doesn't mean, of course, that we stop doing them, but things can become more playful. Maybe that's one way to look at it, is we take it a little less seriously. Maybe it's when I know that I'm caught in the form paradigm, and I've forgotten awareness is when I'm taking something really seriously, and like it must be this way. And this is, you know, how does it play out in our daily life is endlessly complex, and there's no formulas, because it also doesn't mean like, you could say, wouldn't the ideal then be to, like we sometimes have that sense of, just have no views and opinions about anything, right? But, and maybe we can go in that direction, but in fact, the Buddha seemed to like have, you know, ideas about things and suggestions for other people and how things should be done and so on. So it's not exactly that he was like, oh, whatever, it doesn't matter, you know. So this is where it gets really tricky, I think. It's like, how do we feel like something matters, especially maybe from the Bodhisattva vows. I feel like this is important for the awakening of all beings, the benefit of all beings. But I'm not like myself, my body, mind, separate, individual, independent, subject to death, self, is not so invested in it. And I think it's hard to pull those apart sometimes. So we have just a few minutes, so I don't think we'll.
Didn't we get to a pretty big punchline?
We could stop there. We could stop there. Maybe I thought as an exercise, then the rest of the page, which you can read at home, the rest of this chapter is a lot about like self judgment, and guilt and remorse and self-criticism, and I think that's a really great application of all these teachings in a very practical way that, in our culture especially. Maybe just to finish, how about jump all the way down to the bottom of the page, on page 70. We could end with this short meditation. Sit for a minute with any pain or remorse that has a separate self kind of woven into it, and just see it as conditioned experiences, waves on the ocean. So this type of practice is great for forgiving ourselves and for forgiving others. To see that all of this mess is just arising due to conditions, and it really is the formless awareness that we all share, that all these difficulties and feelings and misunderstandings arise from. And therefore we can still confess all my ancient twisted karma, I fully avow, and without putting a big kind of self in there of like, bad, bad one, just I acknowledge these conditioned waves that have arisen due to conditions, and I regret any pain that's come to me or others through this, and now I return to the ocean and continue. So thank you all for exploring this. We didn't get as far as I thought we might. I knew we wouldn't finish the book, but anyone who has the book, you're welcome to finish it, and maybe we'd pick it up at some other time. I think it's a great, and I think this is, I would call it kind of an advanced teaching book. It's I think understandable, but it's really, it's about awakening, paradigm shift of the heart, and the practice of a lifetime. So there's no end to this. So may we all continue and dedicate any positive merit and virtue arisen from our exploration of the divided mind and the formless awareness to the complete freedom and happiness of all living beings. May they realize this formless awareness that they are. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.